It's usually in the form of a declaration. The world's just getting worse and worse. Why, I remember when, and then you can fill that in with whatever declaration you want. I remember when a house only cost $20,000. Why, I remember when you could get a meat and three vegetables, a roll and a drink, and get change back from your nickel. I don't remember that, but... Or I remember when people had respect for each other. And I remember when people treated their neighbors well. And you can go on down the list. And I want to ask the question tonight, and I think this has some theological significance. Is that really a true kind of claim to make? I suppose you could say, well, there's more people in the world now than there ever have been, so technically there's more sin. That's true. But I'd like to remind you that the failure rate among humans has always been right at 100%, because Paul said in Romans 3, verse 23, all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. That has never changed. That will always be true as long as this world persists. I think technology has something to do with this. I read an interesting article, it's been years ago, about the effect of media coverage on bad news and how people perceive things. It gave examples of, for example, mass shootings where a gunman goes in, blows away a whole lot of people. That wasn't invented in the 21st century. Mass murders have been around for a long time, but we have a lot more media coverage. It's instant. It's global. And if something happens in a remote part on the backside of nowhere in Wisconsin, within the next 5 minutes, everybody in the world knows about it. And I think that shapes our perception of what we see in the world around us. I think our perceptions play a role in this. How I look at the world now at the age of 61 is different than how I looked at the world at the age of 21. Now, personally, I don't know that it's necessarily better or worse. It's just I perceive things differently than I once did. Your experiences in life, your exposure to things, shapes your perception of things. Many years ago, I was a volunteer fireman for a couple of years when we lived up in Iowa, and it changed how I looked at a lot of things, changed how I looked at people's sicknesses, how I looked at their experiences of sicknesses. It changed how I looked at fire. I'd never fought a fire in my life, and I had to learn how to do that, had to learn to do it very quickly. I remember one of our training exercises, periodically, people would donate a house, or they would buy a lot. They wanted the house or structure gone, and they would tell the fire department, please come in and burn it for us, so we'd have practice burns. And just a couple of months after I had joined the fire department, we had a practice burn. And one of the exercises was we went up into a room. They filled the room with old newspaper, and they set it on fire. And they had an experienced fireman right there at the door with a fire hose, and then they bring in rookies like me, and you had to sit in the room and watch the flames engulf you. That changes your perception about things. I changed my view of fire very quickly. I always had a healthy respect for fire, but believe me, that got my attention. So the experiences that you have with various things in life can change your perception about a lot of things in the world. So I want to talk tonight about this question, is the world getting worse and worse? Again, I think it's an important question. It's one worth asking, and I think the answers are important. I want to start out just with the question, what is the world? Now, I'm going to look at the Greek word in the New Testament. You can probably look at some words in the Old Testament, but I really want to look at just the New Testament concept primarily. The Greek word is cosmos, and we get our word cosmos from it in English. Cosmos generally is, we think of the universe, but in the New Testament, it actually takes on multiple shades of meaning. It can refer to the created universe, Acts chapter 17, verse 14. The God who made the world and all things in it is not served by human hands as though he needed anything, is what Paul said there. He was talking about the created order, the world and everything in it, the universe, everything that God has spoken into creation. In our scripture reading a moment ago, it sometimes emphasizes just the human beings that God has created. 1 John chapter 2, verse 2, And he is the propitiation for our sins, and not for ours only, but also for those of the whole world, the cosmos. And there it's referring to humans. Trees and dogs and rocks don't need salvation. Humans do. And so there the idea is that of mankind. Sometimes it refers to the present passing evil age. It's used that way in a number of places. For instance, in Ephesians chapter 2, it's not so much a thing as much as it is an era. Ephesians chapter 2 in the opening verses, "And you were dead in your trespasses and sins, in which you formerly walked according to the course of this world, according to the prince of the power of the air, of the spirit that is now working in the sons of disobedience." And there, clearly, world is not so much a thing as much as it is a way of thinking. It's the present passing evil age. It can refer to the value system of this world. For example, in Colossians chapter 2, starting in verse 8, "See to it that no one takes you captive through philosophy and empty deception, according to the tradition of men, according to the elementary principles of the world, rather than according to Christ." And it goes on to talk later in the chapter about some of the false views that some of these Christians had embraced. The world has its own value system that they try not to let God determine what that value system is. So there is mankind's value system, and that is the world, according to Colossians chapter 2. It can also refer to mankind in his hostility toward God. Not just mankind in the sense of 1 John chapter 2, verse 2, but mankind in his opposition to God. I think John captures this beautifully in John chapter 1 when he's talking there about the incarnation of Christ, when God became flesh. And so in John chapter 1, starting in verse 9, "There was the true light, which coming into the world enlightens every man. He was in the world, and the world was made through him, and the world did not know him." Now, in what sense is he talking there about the world? Clearly not the created order, not the rocks and the trees and so forth. It's interesting that when Jesus died on the cross, the world convulsed. The physical world convulsed because of that. The skies became dark. Rocks were split open from the earthquake that happened. The physical world recognized its creator. He's talking here about man. And he's not just talking about the fact that men were simply unaware that God came into the world. As John goes on to show in his gospel, Jesus gave ample evidence that he was God, he was the Son of God, he came to save the world. John over and over talks about the works that Jesus did. This was not lack of evidence, it was willful ignorance. The world did not know him. This is mankind and his hostility toward God. And then also sometimes the word world refers to the dominion of Satan. And so in John chapter 12, John 12 verse 31, Jesus said, "Now judgment is upon this world. Now the ruler of this world," and that's a reference to Satan, "will be cast out." Satan has been given a place of dominion, and the place where his dominion resides is the world. Now, it's not an absolute dominion. We read in Revelation that he has been imprisoned, if you will, for 1,000 years. And there is a restriction that is placed upon Satan and his activities. And so even though this is the dominion of Satan, don't think for a moment that he gets free reign. He doesn't. If he has any reign at all, it is here in this world among men. So that is how the Bible speaks of the world. Now, sometimes people will go to certain texts in the Bible and say, well, these verses prove that the world is in fact getting worse and worse. I want to look at three. These are the three most common texts I see appealed to. First of all, in 2 Timothy chapter 2, or 3, I'm sorry, 2 Timothy chapter 3, 2 Timothy 3 down in verse 13, "But evil men and imposters will proceed from bad to worse, deceiving and being deceived. Well, first of all, he doesn't mention the world. He just mentions a specific category of people, evil men and imposters. And if you go back to the beginning of the chapter, when does he say this is going to take place? Chapter 3, verse 1. But realize this, that in the last days, difficult times will come. Now, premillennialists like to jump on this and say, well, as we get closer and closer to the end of time, even worse things are going to happen. And I don't think that's what Paul is saying at all. Back in Acts chapter 2, when Peter and the apostles began to preach on the day of Pentecost, they quoted from Joel. And Joel said, in the last days. We've been in the last days since the day of Pentecost. And I think that's exactly Paul's point here. In this final era of mankind, there's going to be sin. And he identifies some of it. But I think here he's not just talking about sin generally. I don't think he's talking about evil people generally. I think he's talking specifically about false teachers who would arise among brethren. Notice in verse 5, these people that he's describing in the last days, the evil men and the imposters in verse 13, in verse 5, he says they are holding to a form of godliness, although they have denied its power and they are told to avoid such men as these. Timothy said, don't hang with people like this. And then he also says, among them are those who enter into households and captivate weak women weighed down with sins, led on by various impulses, always learning and never able to come to the knowledge of the truth. He's talking about men who would go into congregations, I believe, and take advantage of women, take advantage of their spiritual weaknesses. And I think here he's talking about false teachers. I don't think this is simply a claim that as we get closer to the end of time, that things are going to get worse and worse generally. He's talking about a particular kind of person in a particular kind of setting. Another text that I've actually seen appealed to is in Matthew chapter 13. Matthew chapter 13, we've got the introduction to Jesus' use of parables. One of the parables that he gave in Matthew 13, verses 24 through 30, is the parable of the tares among the wheat. And when Jesus goes on to explain this, he says, this field in which both wheat and tares are sown, this field is the world. And basically, it's the admixture of good and evil. In verse 30, once the tares are discovered, the servants ask, well, do you want us just to go ahead and pull them up? He said, allow both to grow together until the harvest, and in the time of the harvest I will say to the reapers, first gather up the tares and bind them into bundles and to burn them up, but gather the wheat into my barn. And some actually say, well, see, there evil is constantly growing until the end of time. Well, if you read that carefully, the wheat's growing until the end of time too. If we have more Christians in the world, then righteousness is growing. And yes, there is evil growing as well. They're growing together. Don't miss the point. And again, I think to single that out is to misapply that particular parable. Another text that's appealed to is Matthew chapter 24. Matthew chapter 24 in verse 12. It says, but lawlessness, because lawlessness is increased, most people's love will grow cold. And verse 21, there will be a great tribulation such as not occurred since the beginning of the world until now, nor ever will. That sounds like things are going to be bad, except here's the problem. Matthew 24, at least the first half or two-thirds of the chapter is talking about the destruction of Jerusalem. I think there were visible signs about the coming of, about the impending destruction of Jerusalem, and there were very visible things that they could notice. He's not talking here about the second coming or the end of the world. He doesn't talk about that until you get down to verse 36. But of that day and hour, no one knows, not even the angels of heaven nor the Son, but the Father alone. And he says, we don't know when that's coming. And there aren't going to be the same kinds of signs that you saw with the destruction of Jerusalem. So sometimes people appeal to these texts, and I don't think it's a valid appeal. I think it's misusing these particular texts. I think the best thing to do is look backward through the Scriptures. What did the world look like a long time ago? Before we romanticize it, before we say, oh man, those were good old days. Well, let's see exactly how good they were. So in the days of, let's look at the Adams family, a different Adams family, but anyway. All right, so you go back to Genesis and the creation of Adam and Eve. And when we get to the early chapters of Genesis, we get to Genesis chapter 4. Adam and Eve start having children. So let's assume there are four people on the planet. 25% of those people were murderers. They had two sons. Half of their family was murderers. And this is back, now I don't know how many people were on the earth. We get the sense from Cain's response to his punishment. Apparently by this time there are other people in the world. But folks, this is not a good start. This is the very first family created by God. They had direct communion with God. And one of the first four people in the world was a murderer. They lived in an idyllic setting. Adam and Eve did, and they turned their backs on God in Genesis chapter 3. How is that a good thing? And because of that one sin in Genesis chapter 3, the entire world is affected by that. That doesn't sound particularly promising. You think about Noah's day. Eight people in the entire world were worth saving. How would you like it if your family was the only family in the world that God thought was worth saving? I'm thankful to God. I know a lot of godly people in this world. I know a lot of godly people. The family of God in this place, other Christians that I know all over the country, other Christians that I know in this city, I take a great deal of consolation in that. That there are righteous people throughout the world. In Noah's day, exactly one family. In fact, it actually singles out Noah. Noah alone was righteous in his generation. Maybe God threw in the family for good measure. I'm not really sure. But nonetheless, in Noah's day, there was exactly one godly family at most. Eight people in the whole world. I think about Lot's family. You get to Genesis, I mean, Lot, bless his heart, he just makes one bad decision after another. He's motivated by worldly considerations. His uncle Abraham, I mean, just said, you pick wherever you want to live. And he picked the wealthiest looking place he could find. The place where he thought he would go and make a mint. And it cost him his family. And in Genesis chapter 18 and 19, the Lord comes and tells Abraham what he's going to do. And remember the bargain. Lord, if there are just 10 righteous people, would you save the city? There aren't even 10 righteous people in the town. And you look at Lot, later in the New Testament says his righteous soul was vexed. And I think that's really, that's an optimistic view. Lot's own, he tells, the angels come and tell Lot that the city's about to be destroyed. He tells his sons-in-law, they think he's joking. Now, that's a commentary on the son-in-law's character, but I think it may say something about Lot. Did his sons-in-law not even know when to take him seriously about things? That's worth considering. His own wife didn't want to leave town. I guarantee you, if fire was about to descend on Memphis, we'd get out of town. I'd leave all kinds of stuff behind, and I would not look back. And I know Alethea wouldn't look back. She'd be kicking me, say, come on, let's get out of here, let's go. And things were so bad that his own daughters, lacking faith in God, tricked their dad into getting drunk and sleeping with him so they can have kids. That's not a good situation. That's not a good situation at all. You think about the bondage that Israel went through in the land of Egypt. Infants were openly, brazenly killed. People say, yeah, well, we've got abortion. Yeah, but I think this is a little bit different. They would actually just kill the children openly without any hesitation whatsoever. Those were not good times. I think about the period of the judges. The book of Judges is about the downward spiral of the nation of Israel. There is faithlessness after faithlessness after faithlessness in the story. Even the best of the judges were bad men. Even the best of the judges lacked faith. I've used the illustration before of Samson. If one of my teenage girls had ever brought home a Samson from Bible camp and said, "Oh, Dad, you got to see this guy," I'd say, "Uh-uh, no, no, get rid of him." And at the end of the, by the end of the Judges, we have a massive civil war where almost where one of the tribes is almost wiped out, almost completely obliterated from existence, because they wouldn't stand up to men in their own tribe who were lawless. Women are raped and killed, and the Levite with the concubine, after she gets raped and killed, he hacks up her body and sends the body parts out by FedEx. I mean, are you kidding me? What a horrible, horrible kind of scenario. And those are God's people. Those are the people of God. That's bad. Think about Manasseh's family. Manasseh is the king of the nation. He's of the tribe of Judah, descended from David. And he offers up his children to Moloch. I don't know if you've ever seen statues. It looks sort of like a half human, half dog, had a dog's head, standing upright with arms held outright. They would build a fire around these bronze statues, get them red hot, and they would take an infant and lay them on the arms of this idol, and they would die instantly. And that was the state religion. That was the state religion by one of the Israelites. There is nothing redeemable about that. That's horrible. And then I think about Jesus' day. He had to deal with the scribes and the Pharisees. That was religion. Hypocrisy and all kinds of things. I think about Herod trying to kill infants, the slaughter of the infants in the early chapters of Matthew, where here's a man who is so paranoid, he hears that a baby boy has been born who will someday be the king. This is going to be long after Herod's dead. Herod, you're not going to live forever. But nonetheless, he's so paranoid, he goes to the town of Bethlehem and just kills all of the infant boys, has them slaughtered. That's the kind of paranoia that he had. Things were so bad in Jesus' day that they openly crucified people. And it was done where everybody could see it. In fact, that was the point. The Romans wanted you to see crucifixion because it left a deep impression on your mind. In fact, if you look a little bit more at Greco-Roman culture, the culture of the New Testament, there's all kinds of things that are just so disturbing. Their devotion to idolatry. On every street corner, there were idols, and there were temples made to idols. They actually believed that these carved statues represented gods of some sort. And it was a prevalent belief in idolatry and false gods, emperor worship. In fact, I think one of the best illustrations of the power of idolatry in culture comes from Acts chapter 19. Acts chapter 19 is when Paul was on his third journey. He spent 3 years in the city of Ephesus. And the impact of Christianity was such that it put a dent in the sale of idols. Idolatry was so prevalent, we're told in Acts chapter 19, verse 23, about that time there occurred no small disturbance concerning the way. For a man named Demetrius, a silversmith who made silver shrines of Artemis, was bringing no little business to the craftsmen. These he gathered together with workmen of similar trade and said, "Men, you know that our prosperity depends on this business. We got a good thing going, and these Christians are messing it up." That's how influential idolatry was. It was not only their religion, it was the backbone of their economy. They depended on it. That's how prevalent idolatry was. Belief in demons. If your neighbor was sick, he probably believed that he was demon-possessed. So bringing him a bowl of chicken soup probably ain't going to help him. Going to the doctor, he probably had... Back in those days, if you were sick, you went to the priest at your local shrine because you believed it was a matter of demons or gods, the gods punishing you in some way. immoral religious cults. You know, in 1 Corinthians chapter 6, when Paul talks about the use of prostitutes, folks, I think we need to wrap our heads around this. Paul is saying there were Christians in the church in Corinth who were going to prostitutes and using their services, and Paul has to convince them that's a bad thing. That's how bad it was in Corinth. This is the church of God in Corinth. That was awful. But the background of this, about 100 years before the time of Paul, there was a major temple in the city of Corinth that staffed 1,000 prostitutes. They were the priests and priestesses. That was their religion. When a boy became of age, his father would take him down to the temple and introduce him to a prostitute. That was their religion. That was their religion. We can talk about denominationalism all we want to. I don't think it's that bad. Not yet. It's bad. But that was their common religious belief. Trade guilds. Trade guilds were similar to trade unions. We just read about that in Acts chapter 19. There would be a guild of tradesmen with similar crafts. There were leather workers' guilds. There were silversmiths and goldsmith guilds. There were meat cutters' guilds. And the thing is, they would offer, each guild had its own patron deity. You know, in 1 Corinthians chapter 8, verse 1, Paul talks about meat offered to idols. And later in chapter 10, he talks about going to the marketplace and buying meat that had been dedicated to idols. If you belong to a trade guild, what that generally meant was you had a patron deity, and every day when you would get ready to do your business, you'd make some kind of sacrifice to the patron deity. So there's a good likelihood that if you went to the marketplace and bought bread, you bought meat, you bought whatever you bought, it had already been dedicated to idols. That was the business world of their day. The amphitheaters and the theaters and the coliseums were places of gross immorality. We complain about how bad TV has become, and I'll grant you it's bad. But how would you like to go to a coliseum and watch men fight each other to the death? This isn't movies. This isn't CGI. It's not special effects. This isn't fake blood. These are human beings fighting to the death, and that was entertainment. Or sometimes they would go and watch, they would watch these gladiators fight wild animals. And during the time of Nero, you'd watch Christians fight wild animals. And in their theaters, I mean, look, pornography is bad, and we see all kinds of pornographic content readily available on TV. In places like Asia Minor, you could go to the theater and there would be teenagers performing sexual acts on stage. That was their entertainment. That was their entertainment. Oop. Slavery. At times, half of the population of the Roman Empire was enslaved. That's a cold, hard fact. If you were a slave, you were the property of somebody else. If you had debt and couldn't pay it off these days, you just go to a lawyer, file bankruptcy, in a few years you're fine. Still get to keep your car and your house and probably your big screen TV too. Back in those days, if you couldn't pay your debt, oh, they didn't care about your credit score. They just drag you off to whoever you owed money to, and you became their slave until you paid it off. Child exposure. In Romans chapter 1, in verse 31, the Apostle Paul uses the phrase, he describes some in the Roman world as being without natural affection. That's a reference to child exposure. In Greek and Roman culture, if you had a child that you didn't want, basically households were very favorably disposed to male children. If you were a female, if you were born female, tough luck for you. Most likely, they would take you out to a spot on the edge of town, often by a river. They would just lay you out on the rocks, and you would die. You would either get attacked by wild animals, or you just suffer exposure, and you would die. And that was perfectly acceptable. By the way, Christians got a reputation in the early centuries of the Roman Empire because they knew where these places of exposure were. They would go and rescue the children. But in ancient times, child exposure was perfectly legitimate. If you had deformities as a child, or if they just didn't want you, we got enough, don't really like this one. Bless your heart, if you were ugly, they would just leave you to die. And that was culture. That was the culture into which Jesus came. I think there's a point to that. There are three places in the New Testament that talk about Jesus dying at exactly the right time. Romans chapter 5, verse 6. At the right time, Paul says, Christ died for the ungodly. In Galatians chapter 4, verse 4, in the fullness of time, God sent his son, born of a woman. And then Hebrews chapter 9, verse 26, Christ died at the consummation of the ages. I think what all of this is saying is that the conditions, not just the date on the calendar, but the moral conditions had to be of such a certain kind before God could send his son. And I think it's telling us that things were really bad in Jesus' day. When sin was at its worst, when the world was at its worst, God sent his son to die on the cross for us. That's not to say that our world isn't bad. It is. But here's the thing. We need to remember that the world is now what the world has always been. Mankind in rebellion against God. Things are not worse, they're not better. Things are just sinful. As they have always been. As they always will be. Over in Ecclesiastes, a couple of statements, and we need to take this to heart. Sometimes it exposes us in our thinking. Ecclesiastes chapter 7, there's two statements in chapter 7 that I've always thought about in regard to this question about is the world getting worse. Ecclesiastes 7 verse 8, the end of a matter is better than its beginning. Patience of spirit is better than haughtiness of spirit. There's a sense in which things do get better as you get older, as you experience more. There should be a positivity to that, but really, verse 10, do not say, this is Solomon, who experienced a few things, maybe you remember that. Ecclesiastes 7, verse 10, do not say, why is it that the former days were better than these? For it is not from wisdom that you ask about this. His point is, it's kind of foolish to look back through rose-colored glasses at the good old days. I don't doubt that there were some good things about the good old days. You know, that meal where you get all that food and get change back from your nickel, I'd love that, you know. Yeah, things are more expensive now. But you know what? I like some of the technology that we have now. I'm glad I don't have to get up every morning and chop wood. I push a couple of buttons on my little thermostat and life's good. There's a lot of things about technology I enjoy. But we can get so consumed with how bad things are that we lose our perspective. And I think that's the point that Solomon's making. And I think when you look objectively at the world of the New Testament, things could be a lot worse than what they actually are. I want to end by asking the question, so, okay, Cloyce, yeah, nice point, so what? Actually, I think there is some significance to all of this. Number one, if we have this kind of view that our world is just getting worse and worse and worse and worse all the time, I think it affects our influence. Do you like being around negative, dull people who constantly fret about everything? I don't. And if we present to the, we are supposed to be filled with the hope of God. We're supposed to be filled with the love of God. We're supposed to be filled with faith. And if we present to the world this viewpoint that, well, the world's just collapsing around us as we speak, how is that? How do we hope to be lights in the world with that kind of mentality? I don't think we can be. Secondly, it affects our evangelism. I know a lot of people who pretty much don't do evangelism, and they'll throw up their head, well, this world is just so awful. Don't let yourself fall into that trap. This world may be awful, but there are still people who are hungering and thirsting for God, and we need to go find them. This world may be awful, but let's not give up hope on those who need Jesus. And if we're not careful, this negative view that we have of the world around us can affect the way we evangelize as well. It also affects our faith. Do you really believe that the gospel has the power to change people? Paul said in Romans 1:16, I'm not ashamed of the gospel. It is the power of God unto salvation for everyone who believes, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. And by the way, after that, he launches into that awful discussion in Romans 1 about how bad his world was. But he was convinced that the gospel has the answer to that. Don't despair, but have faith in the power of the gospel. And finally, it affects our joy and it affects our hope. Don't let your view of the world rob you of the joy and the peace and the hope that we have in Christ Jesus. You remember in John chapter 14, as Jesus was delivering his farewell address to his apostles, Romans chapter 14, down in verse 27, peace I leave with you, my peace I give to you, not as the world gives do I give to you. Do not let your heart be troubled, nor let it be fearful. If we focus on the sin around us, we will lose our joy and we will lose our hope. And Jesus said, you keep your eyes on me. You remember what I have given to you. I've given you something that the world cannot. And so we need to change the horizon. We need to quit looking at things under the sun and start looking to the sun, who can give us hope and joy, who is the anchor of all that we believe. We need to remember that God loved the world so much that he gave his only begotten Son, that whoever believes in him should not perish but have everlasting life. That's the world. And God loved it enough to send his Son to die for it. Now, we're told that the world is a corrupt place, 2 Peter chapter 1, verse 4. God has given us the means through the gospel to escape the corruption that is in the world. So, yeah, we need to be concerned about the world. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that we have a flippant view. I'm just saying we need to avoid having a wrong view of it. So if you're here this evening and you've never obeyed Jesus as Lord, if you're caught up in the world and all of its attractions, you need to make some changes to your life. For those of us that are Christians, maybe at some point you've been caught up in the world again. If that's the case, you need to make some corrections. If we can help you in any way, we invite you to come forward while we stand and sing.